Timothy Leary lives. No, 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 he's outside looking in. Timothy Leary lives. No, 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 he's outside.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh. June 19th is Juneteenth. 45 states and the District of Columbia recognize Juneteenth as a holiday or a holiday observance. Since this edition of Free Culture Radio is being recorded on June 19th, we make a technical departure from our usual coverage of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society to talk about history and contemporary politics. Harry Jones was an author and historian who served as the assistant director and curator of the African American Civil War Freedom Foundation and Museum in Washington, D.C. On June 19, 2015, he gave the opening address at the Juneteenth Book Festival Symposium on Black Literature and Literacy, which was held at the Library of Congress. Here now is Harry Jones with the true story of Juneteenth.
Today, I will begin by telling you a lie. That lie is that on June 19th, 1865, slaves in Texas finally learned that they had been freed by the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1, 1863. This lie has been advanced in legislation, in the popular culture, as an explanation for Juneteenth celebration. This lie is predicated on a fundamental misunderstanding of the Emancipation Proclamation and its enforcement. President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1, 1863 as, quote, a fit and necessary war measure for suppressing said rebellion, close quote. In that fit and necessary war measure, President Lincoln declared forever free all persons held as slaves in the 10 states that were at war with the United States for their independence on January 1, 1863. In the 5 slaveholding states that did not accept Abraham Lincoln as, that accepted Abraham Lincoln as president, the Emancipation Proclamation did not apply. It only applied to the states that had to be brought back into the Union by military conquest. On September 22, 1862, in the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln warned the rebellious states, giving them 100 days to return to the Union, or he was going to declare free their slaves. Frederick Douglass, 8 days later, wrote in his monthly that in order for the Emancipation Proclamation to free any slaves, 2 conditions had to be met. The first condition was that the states in rebellion still had to be in rebellion as of January 1, 1863. And the second condition was, quote, we must have the ability to put down the rebellion, close quote. In late 1862, the enslaved knew that in order to be freed by the Emancipation Proclamation, they would have to contribute to suppressing the rebellion, thus to preserving the Union. And this would have to be done through military conquest. Thus began their military campaign for emancipation and Union. It was understood by many members of Congress, the President's cabinet, the Confederate legislature, and Jefferson Davis, the President of the Confederacy, that the Emancipation Proclamation was a cry for help to America's African descent population. Jefferson Davis told the Confederate legislature in January 1863 that the Emancipation Proclamation was, quote, an authentic statement by the government of the United States of its inability to subjugate the South by force of arms, close quote. Meanwhile, in Texas, there is clear evidence that enslaved persons in Galveston knew of the Emancipation Proclamation in late 1862. Galveston was captured by the Union Navy in October 1862, a Navy comprised of 25% African-American sailors. The Austrian consul at Galveston wrote a letter to the Union naval commander, Admiral William Renshaw, stating that Texas slaves had run away and been given refuge by Renshaw's fleet. The council wanted to know if his slaves ran away, would the admiral return them? Renshaw unequivocally said no. Only a small army force, the 42nd Massachusetts Infantry, was assigned to occupy Galveston, and the rebels recaptured Galveston on the day the final Emancipation Proclamation was issued, January 1, 1863. Union soldiers and sailors were taken as prisoners of war, and these Union soldiers and sailors, with knowledge of the Emancipation Proclamation, reported contact with enslaved Texans, as some were assigned to the POWs as cooks. The Union strategic plan neglected military operations in Texas through much of 1863. Lincoln's priority in the West was on controlling the Mississippi River. And Lincoln believed that the only way the Mississippi could be controlled is with the help of the African descent population. When General Nathaniel Banks started a Texas expedition along the Red River, he was ordered back to the Mississippi in support of General Ulysses S. Grant's campaign against Vicksburg. The Louisiana Native Guards, the first African descent regiment mustered into the Union Army, under the field command of African descent commissioned officers led by Captain Andre Carlew, assaulted the rebel position at Port Hudson along the Mississippi three times on May 27, 1863. Though these sable soldiers failed to capture the rebel fort, they were successful in keeping the rebels at Port Hudson from reinforcing the rebels at Vicksburg. Therefore, they had accomplished their primary objective. Grant captured Vicksburg on July 4th, 1863. Now, Lincoln had called Vicksburg the key to victory. And after capturing Vicksburg, Grant wrote to President Lincoln and told President Lincoln that Vicksburg could not have been captured when it was without the help of these African-American soldiers. The general goes on to tell the president, quote, "By arming the Negro, we have added a powerful ally," close quote. Such powerful allies would participate in General Banks' Texas expedition in November 1863. Rebel blockade runners were able to bring supplies into Texas along Texas' southernmost coast. And Banks was ordered to take that part of the Texas coast. Five Corps d'Afrique regiments comprised of African-American soldiers from Louisiana, took part in Banks' successful Texas expedition, making up 10% of the conquering force, capturing and conquering the Texas Gulf Coast from Indianola to Brownsville. These conquering soldiers brought word of the Emancipation Proclamation to Texas. John Bates was 10 years old when these military operations were going on in Texas. Bates pointed out in his WPA slave narrative that word, quote, "traveled pretty fast," and that's P-U-R-T-Y, traveled pretty fast in Limestone County, Texas, where he was enslaved. Indeed, Bates goes on to report that it was the enslaved on the plantation where he was that told the planter that they were free. The first state in rebellion to be brought back in the Union, thus having its enslaved freed by the Emancipation Proclamation, was Arkansas. It took 1 year and 4 months to enforce the Emancipation Proclamation in a rebellious state. And that state was not Virginia with its proximity to Washington. That state was the western state of Arkansas, bordering Texas. When Arkansas was brought back into the Union as a free state on April 11, 1864, there were thousands of African descent soldiers enforcing the Emancipation Proclamation in Arkansas. Meanwhile, back in the East, in 1864, African descent soldiers for the first time were deployed in the Army of the Potomac after General Grant became the general in charge in command of all the armies. In December 1864, General Benjamin F. Butler, the commander of the Department of Virginia and North Carolina, organized the 25th Army Corps. the only Army Corps in American history made up of only African descent regiments. Butler wrote of his African descent soldiers, quote, "Better soldiers never shouldered a musket," close quote. General Grant wrote in his memoirs that on April 3rd, 1865, the 25th Army Corps, under the command of General Godfrey Weitzel, captured Richmond, Virginia, the capital of the Confederacy. The headlines in a Washington, D.C. newspaper, the National Republican, read, quote, "Glorious fall of Richmond captured by the black troops," close quote. These sable soldiers of the 25th went on to stop Robert E. Lee's army at Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia, forcing his surrender there on April 9, 1865. Though some contemporary scholars falsely claim that these highly regarded soldiers were prohibited from participating in the Grand Review of the Armies in Washington on May 23rd and 24th, 1865, because of their race, without complaint, these highly motivated sable soldiers stood ready to go to Texas and enforce the Emancipation Proclamation in May of 1865. Thomas Morse Chester, an African descent war correspondent, reported that on the eve of the Grand Review, the word that they were embarking for Texas was received in their camps, quote, "with a great deal of satisfaction." Out in Texas, African descent soldiers who had been there for months engaged rebel soldiers in combat in May of 1865. Galveston was captured and occupied by the Union Navy on June 5, 1865. By the end of the first week of June, the 25th Army Corps and thousands of other reinforcements were arriving in the Lone Star State. In the early morning of June 15th, 1865, the rebel governor and thousands of rebel soldiers were chased out of the United States into Mexico by this imposing Union force. The tradition of the Juneteenth ball on June 16th was thus established. General Gordon Granger was the commander of the new Department of Texas. His immediate superior, General Phil Sheridan, ordered Granger to publish general orders informing the people of Texas that all the laws enacted by the rebel governor and legislature were null and void, that federal laws applied, and thus the Emancipation Proclamation had freed all the slaves in Texas forever. Granger arrived in Galveston on June 19, 1865. And he reported to General Sheridan that when he arrived that morning, there was a brigade of the 25th Army Corps already in Galveston. Over 1,000 African American soldiers, heroes of Virginia, were in Galveston over a week before Granger showed up. Later that day, Granger published General Order Number 3 and the military campaign for emancipation and union was officially declared over. Let us therefore celebrate the 150th anniversary of the end of this successful campaign for emancipation and union. On this Juneteenth, let us embrace the truth, reject the lie, and pledge ourselves to achieving liberty and justice for all in this, our indivisible American Republic. Thank you.
That was author and historian Harry Jones speaking about the Juneteenth holiday at a Library of Congress symposium in 2015. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh. On this installment of Free Culture Radio, we're talking about Juneteenth and race in America. Judge William Murphy Jr. is an attorney and civil rights activist in Baltimore, Maryland. He was the attorney for the family of Freddie Gray, the young man who was murdered by Baltimore police in April 2015. On the first anniversary of Freddie Gray's death, I had the good fortune to meet Judge Murphy. He was kind enough to grant me this interview.
It's been a year since the murder of Freddie Gray and the uprisings, and we've had the growth of Black Lives Matter and politicians paying amazing amounts of lip service to what needs to be done. It's been a year out. What's changed?
Nothing's changed, which means that, in fact, things have changed for the worse, because the cycle of poverty gets worse all by itself, and only 10% of the people in poverty ever get out of it. And so unless you do something radical to reverse poverty, it's here to stay. And none of the politicians up to this point in time in Baltimore have put a dent in it, because it's gotten progressively worse from the time that we had Mayor Schaefer to the time that we had Mayor Blake. So it's a sorry lack of effort, A, and B, it's a lack of intellectual effort to come up with the solutions to this problem. And we ought to be able to do it. We ought to be able to solve it. And these kids are at risk, because as long as we have poverty, we have kids who are not taught what they need to know about the world, about themselves. And so that's why they remain in poverty, and they remain a drag on the economy. Nobody wants to have to subsidize anybody. And if we ignore the problems of people, that's exactly what we'll end up doing. They need great schools. They need great homes. They need the great neighborhoods like we had. That's why we flowered, you know, and you don't have that stuff. The arrogant among us think, well, we did it ourselves. No, we didn't. This was a village that nurtured us. But when that village is no longer either a village or nurturing, then these kids raise themselves, and the results are always, always very, very bad. And don't point to the few that get out as an excuse to not do anything about the overwhelming number of people who don't. And that's what the Republicans do. They blame it all on the kids. You know, it's not a kid's fault that, you know, it doesn't have parents, and then they blame it all on the parents. Well, if you've got mass incarceration, you know, one of the parents is going to be away for a long, long time. And so then you got a mother who's left doing it all by herself. And if she came up in poverty, she doesn't have the education to break out of it. And the cycle goes on and on and on. It worsens and it worsens and it worsens. So that's what's happened since Freddie Gray died. And by the way, I was Freddie Gray's family's lawyer.
That's one of the reasons I wanted to ask you about this. How are the cases going? I should ask for an update. That's a news thing.
Well,
how are the cases?
I handled this personal injury case, and we settled that for $6.4 million. I'm not involved in any way greater than you in the criminal cases. I've been a commentator about them because, you know, I was a criminal lawyer for a long time. And those cases,
criminal defense lawyer.
Criminal defense lawyer. And I represented people charged with crime, and, you know, for about 29 years. Then I was on the bench here for about 3 years on the circuit court. And I can tell you that our criminal justice system is part of the mass incarceration machine. And we didn't really have an awareness of it the way we should have for years and years. And then when we got an awareness beginning around 1995, when the data was overwhelming and the trends were clear, nobody did anything about it. And it took the Freddie Gray case for the legislature to pass the most comprehensive package of sentencing reforms in the history of Maryland this past session. So they reacted by doing something. But nothing like that's happened in Baltimore City, where it's largely business as usual. You know, sympathy without empathy, without a programmatic response to stop what's going on.
I'm glad to know that Maryland's passed its package. I was talking to Jason Zeidenberg with Justice Policy Institute. They've been working with the legislature for quite a while, and that was one of the one of the best bits of the year, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've noticed that personally, and the people I interact with, every time something happens, everyone trots out their best sympathy faces, and they say a lot of great things and make a lot of promises, and then jack all happens and we're back to where we were before. And myself, and for a lot of people, we're just getting tired of that. It's like we're done with saying thank you so much for saying something that wasn't screwed up and accepting the fact that nothing happens after that. I mean, I'm guessing, I, I don't know. Is that becoming more typical? I mean, are we just...
Well, it's always been the rule, especially with liberals. You know, there are some really great liberals who roll their sleeves up and actually try to do the work in a hands-on way, or they do the work in a theoretical way for as guides for the rest of us. But most people of goodwill just look over the edge of the cliff and they see us down in this bomb crater, and they don't come down. They say, oh, look at that. That's so bad. And they go on about their business. Many of them are great people, but they just don't care enough about what's happening in that bomb crater to join us or to guide us or to reach down and pull us out or anything. And so this becomes an independent entity. West Baltimore, East Baltimore, poverty, violence, drugs, families disappearing, men disappearing. And, you know, it's not enough to talk about it. You got to roll your sleeves up. This is our city. We got to roll our sleeves up and solve that problem so this can become an extraordinary city, not just a good city. And we have that potential. But people have got to stop what they're doing and do something differently. They can't just talk. They can't just sympathize. That really doesn't move the ball forward.
I'll get to the drug policy for a second while I think about another question. But how would you say, do you think that the Black Lives Matter movement and the everything since the murder of Freddie Gray and the media finally paying attention, how has that influenced drug policy debate that's going on, the way we talk about these things?
Well, the Black Lives Movement is in its infancy. It started essentially in Ferguson. And it's kids, you know, youngsters. And all they're good at so far is disruption. And that's a great thing because, you know, when you ask questions in embarrassing circumstances to politicians who have never been prepared to give those answers, you kind of expose them. And they get angry because they've been exposed. And the rest of us go, oh, my God, he didn't know. Or she didn't know. Wow. And so they serve a vital function. And as they get more and more sophisticated, they're going to play a more effective role in this movement. And my hat's off to them for doing what they've done so far.
You're a very busy man, and I know you've got a lot of things to do, but I just, if you have, you have some thoughts for listeners, this is going to be on radio station KBOO in Portland, Oregon. It's a majority white city. It's horribly segregated. We have a long history of police violence and brutality against people of color and also against people with disabilities, mental and occasionally physical. It's a city that's, on the other hand, very, very progressive and liberal and hates the fact that it's really as screwed up as it is. Any advice for places like that?
I have a lot of faith in today's young people. They seem to be disconnected from the old ways, and that's good. But sometimes they're a little too disconnected because they don't read about the old ways. They don't understand how we got here. And for them, just go back and read about Richard Nixon and what he did to join the bigotry of the South into the Republican Party. It was called the Southern Strategy. Remember that the Republicans had the majority of the votes for the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, which revolutionized the American South, but it didn't change many minds. And then Richard Nixon came along in order to beat a really, really great progressive leader, Hubert Humphrey, who was President Johnson's vice president. He came up with that Southern strategy to get all of the arch segregationists, all of the overt bigots, all of the overt racists who were in charge of every Southern state, all of that leadership, U.S. senators, congresspersons, governors, legislators, completely racist bunch. He invited them to join the Republican Party as their new home. He didn't want them there so that he could subject them to a re-education. He brought them there to accommodate their racism. And since 68, the Republicans have two general philosophies. One, let's do everything corporate America wants. And number two, let's keep people divided in the South and wherever else we can divide them on the basis of the color of their skin so that they can be easily manipulated. And that's what you've seen over the past many, many years. So Republicans ought to understand that, and they don't. And they ought to understand why that's been the home of racism ever since 1968, and they won't. And so Republicans need to know that every time that they vote for saving taxes, they're stuck with the whole agenda, that whole racist agenda. And you see it manifesting in Donald Trump today. You see it manifesting in Ted Cruz. These are two men who've never done anything to solve the problem created by racism in America, to solve the problems of poverty, this, that, and the other. You got one who's a narcissist and the other who is just a calculating, miserable human being. And so we have a choice between those two on the Republican side, and the Republicans only have themselves to blame because they've nurtured this racism. They've kept it going ever since 1968. So, you know, vote Democratic. And that's the only chance we have to make real reform in the country. You know, Hillary Clinton may not be everything everybody wants, but look at the alternatives. My God, the alternatives will take us back so far to the ugliness of the past, to the place where people really had it even worse than they have it today. And we can't regress. This is a progressive country. We are the leaders of where the rest of the world should be going. And we can't go back to the old racism. We can't go back to xenophobia. We have to reach out and set an example as a country of what great values are all about, where everybody is welcome, everybody has a chance for opportunity, and to each according to his needs, hopefully, and his abilities.
That was my interview with Baltimore civil rights activist and attorney Judge William Murphy Jr. It was recorded in April 2016, a year after the murder of Freddie Gray by officers in the Baltimore Police Department. And for now, that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!